Okay, now that you're away, good afternoon. We're happy to be here in our third day, day three of our series, Secrets to Brain Health. Now, as Pastor Bog said, it's important. It's a passion for us to bring this knowledge to you. And yet, he's right about one thing. We tried our best to bring the latest that we know. And it's exciting because a lot of this research, a lot of this experience, clinical findings are basically confirming what we kind of know already. There's nothing like whole plant-based foods and the benefits of sleeping and exercise and so forth. Today is a topic that is basically very important for us as individuals that everybody should know. What nutrition does to our brain and to a whole organism, basically. And so we don't pretend to preach to you because a lot of these findings we haven't done it ourselves. We have chosen not to bring our own research because there's so much out there, wonderful stuff that we say, you know what, forget about our stuff and bring what other people are doing. But they coincide with some of the findings we have. And we're passionate about this because it has made an impact in our lives, both Rhoda and myself. And we want to share this with you with this passion that we have because we have been basically, we have improved our health because of this knowledge that we keep discovering. So by no means we have attained the ceiling of knowledge. We keep discovering truths, we keep discovering new things, and we get excited by the day. So we want to share some of this information with you. Are you ready for this? Great. So Rhoda, because of this truth, because of this, the nature of the experience that we have, Rhoda will share a personal story with you to begin, and we'll continue with the seminar.
So today we've talked about stress management this week, we've talked about exercise and resting. Today we're going to talk about nutrition, and nothing kind of gets people a little nervous or self-conscious than to talk about nutrition. I'm a dietitian. I went to school for dietetics, and what I noticed is after I graduated, and you would tell people, I'm working as a dietitian or I'm a dietitian, would automatically, if you're at potluck, they automatically cover their plates and say, make comments like, well, I don't normally eat this way. So they get a little self-conscious. And then, of course, I went to medical school after I worked as a dietitian here in West Virginia, by the way. I worked for 3 years at Charleston Area Medical Center, Women and Children's Hospital.
You can do it.
And went to Loma Linda and became a psychiatrist. So at the same time, people kind of get self-conscious when they find out you're a psychiatrist as well. So that is, so again, we're going to talk about nutrition and how it affects the brain. And just to kind of give my own personal story in how I came to this knowledge and am still learning, it is starting out when I was a child. I was raised in an Adventist home, raised vegetarian. We did tend to eat a lot of foods from the garden, a lot of fruits and vegetables, but we were vegetarian. We ate eggs and cheese and milk. We didn't eat, huge amounts of those things because they were more expensive than the foods that we got from the garden, but we did eat those. And I did have some health problems related to that, constipation, for example. But I kind of had the thin body type, and people would comment about that. So I had kind of my self-image was based on how I looked and that I was thin. And also I would think, am I too thin? Should I gain weight? Kind of looking at other people, thinking what should my body look like, trying to match other people's bodies. But not really thinking much about food because, as my mom can tell you, she would tell me, I have a hollow leg. I could eat anything. I could eat everything. I could eat a lot of food and not gain weight. But then I went to Academy, and we actually had a cook that year. I was a sophomore at Academy, and we had a cook that year that deep fried everything. She deep fried the vegetables, she deep fried everything. And I was not used to that kind of food. My mom never deep fried anything. So I gained 20 pounds during the first 4 to 5 months at Academy. So this kind of started a cycle. You can see about a 20-pound weight shift. This is not me, but just looking at, you know, how people look at their bodies and their weight shifts. And this can be unhealthy weight fluctuations, and I think that I was doing that. At the same time, I heard Dr. Agatha Thrash speak. She spoke, I'm not quite sure when, it was sometime around that period, right before or right after I started Academy. And she really impressed me, talking about, I think she was the first person that I ever heard talk about how animal foods in the diet was not good, eggs and cheese and dairy and those kind of things. She talked about that. And in my mind at that age, I was like, oh, really? I was thinking about that. And I went on to become a dietitian. And I did change my diet at that time. I got interested while I was a teenager in nutrition. And I did change my diet. I stopped eating the food that they had at the cafeteria. I was eating just the vegetables and the bread and the peanut butter. I wasn't eating the processed food or the eggs or the cheese or the dairy. But what no one told me was that you actually have to eat more food when you're eating a whole food plant-based diet. You have to eat more. And so that can lead to unhealthy weight fluctuations. So you start to restrict, you're not getting enough food, you deprive yourself, you start craving other foods, you give in, guilt. This is a common cycle that people are in the diet. And I saw other women around me struggling with diet cycles as well. So moving on, going to college, kind of struggling still with food cravings, binge eating, also with depression started to come in to that food cycle. And then I went to Loma Linda, became a physician, but still struggling some with depression. I ran 2 marathons while I was at Loma Linda, very good experience. But then you go into residency and you don't have as much time to exercise, then fellowship, you're very busy, and some unhealthy weight fluctuations. And really, through all my training in dietetics, food nutrition, food service management, medical school, I never really got the correct information about nutrition. Everything to put it together until I went this past year in 2016 to the International Plant-Based Nutrition and Healthcare Conference in Anaheim, California. And that is really started putting it together. I had also read this book called Whole by T. Colin Campbell. So it was a process over time, reading different books from T. Colin Campbell. This book is very good. It talks about putting everything together as a whole food, how the whole food is greater than the sum of its parts, and how Western medicine takes things down to one nutrient and discovers very reductionistic thinking of one nutrient, rather than the whole food. So he is over 50-year researcher in nutrition, and really discovering what he says about that. And then to see all these professionals learning about the whole food plant-based diet. And we were there for 4 days at this conference, and we ate nothing but whole foods. So we had whole foods, no processed food, no oil, no dairy products, no eggs, no cheese, and no sugar, just whole foods. And after eating 4 days, breakfast, lunch, dinner, whole foods, I really felt a difference in my thinking, in my brain, and the sharpness of my thinking. So I just continued after that, just continued with the whole food, plant-based, and really strictly taking out the animal products. Now, I had thought that I was eating pretty healthy before that. I was eating a lot of vegetables, a lot of fruits, and I would never, I mean, I would have considered mostly vegan, actually, even before that. But I wouldn't have, so I wouldn't have considered my diet unhealthy. But I did gain benefits after that. Dry eyes went away that I was struggling with. Depression has not returned after that. And also my cholesterol. So the year before, each year at the job that I have now, we do a healthy you, and they check your cholesterol and all your blood chemistry, as well as your weight and so forth. And the 2016 in March, I had all of that done, and all of it was good. My LDL, bad cholesterol, was 99. And everything else was good. I got $600 for all my blood and health status measures being good. But after 4 or 5 months on the whole food plant-based diet, my LDL cholesterol is 67 in March of 2017. So it went from 99, which is not heart attack proof, to 67. Which anything below 75 is considered heart attack proof. So even though I was mostly vegan before, still had big benefits from going fully plant-based. So that's my testimony.
Well, thank you, Rhoda. If she considering herself a healthy young woman or adult can benefit from something like this, I'm sure anybody would want to do this. So let's explore what the types of diet are. And as I said, basically what we want is we want to open our minds to the evidence. This is not our evidence. This is what's out there done by very dedicated professionals. And so let's delve into it. First off, why don't we begin by exploring how many of you have heard of the SAD diet? Okay, you know it. I'm talking about the standard American diet. And this is based on what is normally consumed in a typical American table. We have the picture says it all, right? I don't have to walk you through what each is. Don't forget the coffee there. It's a very key component of this American diet. But let's break it down into calories, right, shall we? Excuse me. So here we have 32 teaspoons of sugar per day equaling 500 kilocalories. This is typically what it is present in the American diet. 51 of this typical diet is basically comes from refined and processed foods or comprises refined and processed foods. About 42% is made up of dairy and animal foods. Only about 7% of this is comprised by fruits and vegetables. 2% out of this 7% basically belongs or is comprised by potato chips and French fries, which after all are vegetables, right, technically. It's just that they're coated neatly in oil. So here's a dramatic pie chart. This reveals to you basically what's going on with the standard American diet. Here we have about 51% in which everything is processed. Think about that. Half, roughly. Then we have about 47% of dairy and animal foods. Everything that has to do with animal products there. And about 7% as we said. So this chart was really quite dramatic. Let me introduce you to another diet. Would you guys happen to guess what is here? Actually, before I move on, I'd like to talk to you about something. Rhoda, have you, by the way, let me ask you, do you care to tell us what patients say about this diet? Because you see some of these folks, don't you?
Well, most people that I talk to think that their diet is pretty healthy. And so when you say, well, you know, have you considered your diet? Because most people don't want to take medication. That's my experience as a psychiatrist. They want to avoid, especially for their children, to take medication. And when I start talking about diet as part of alternative treatments to you know, psychiatric disorders, they automatically say, well, we eat a pretty good diet. We are eating chicken.
Chicken. And actually, I jumped the gun, but here's a chart about chicken. I was so anxious to show you about, you know, the figures on. This is basically the meat eating habits. And this is a projection that studies have shown. This is the consumption per capita, the per capita of each meat. This is per individual in the U.S. So here we have the projections of, or the figures for poultry, which leads the pack in consumption. Actually, has been increasing steadily since the 1970s. And this is the orange line, as you see, for poultry. Now, what about red meats? This is beef. It actually has been decreasing slightly, as seen by this burgundy line right here. Bacon has remained steady. And of course, sheep, which we don't consume, or the people here in the U.S. don't consume a lot, has remained kind of at the bottom. But notice this meat, the poultry. It has been increasing and is expected to keep increasing due to the increasing population in the U.S. Now, let me introduce you to another diet. What do you guys think this diet is or belongs to? Any guesses?
Sad diet.
Sad diet. How many think it's a sad diet? Okay. How many do not think it's a sad diet? You don't think so? Okay. She says, my friend, your name? Kathy says it's an all paleo diet. The paleo, okay? Sure enough. I mean, how many? Any other guesses? Well, let me tell you, this is another sad diet, but this is the standard Adventist diet. Wait a minute, are you sure? Well, the difference here is that all of these products are vegan. But this closely resembles what type of diet? The American diet, but this is vegan. And you would argue, wait a minute, but what's going on here? Well, the difference is, here's a nice veggie dog. This is a processed veggie link. As we know, some of us have consumed this at some point or another. Here's a combination of bacon, the quintessential veggie bacon, nicely wrapped around a link. And of course, French fries shall not be missing from this nice combination, because we want to, you know, kind of make it look nice. And of course, here we have the veggie burger. So the veggie burger, all of this is vegan with the vegan cheese and everything. Look, don't forget in the background, the French fries. And I always wonder, why French? I mean, did they invent it, or how is that connection? But anyway, this basically is not high in cholesterol. Well, not really, because it doesn't come from animal products, but is equally high in fats. So think about that. Now, speaking of Seventh-day Adventists, such a neat group we are, aren't we? Well, the Seventh-day Adventists are ideal for studies in nutrition, and I'll tell you why. Well, I don't say it. I haven't said this for the first time, but I concur with the observations of many experts. As a matter of fact, the Seventh-day Adventists are very, very sought group. They're quite popular with scientists, especially nutritionists, clinicians, endocrinologists, you name it. You want to know why? Well, the Seventh-day Adventists are a very homogeneous group. We don't smoke. We don't drink alcohol. Almost negligible amounts of caffeine intake. And we also have similar networks, social network, that is. We network in the same fashion, so to speak. And you know what I'm talking about. But what is very different about us is that not all Seventh-day Adventists have the same diet. Aha! This is the scenario for an excellent studying group, and that's exactly what the government said, we're going to fund you to conduct studies. How many of you have heard of the Adventist Health Studies? Everyone. Here it is. So here's the first figures that came out of the studies, these studies, exploring the dietary habits of Seventh-day Adventists. Here we have five groups. So I'm going to walk you through. Mind you, okay, please take into consideration that the number of sample Seventh-day Adventists is quite large, in the thousands. So this is a very reliable data. I just wanted to show you the percentage of Seventh-day Adventists that belong to each group. Vegans, about 8%. Okay, then lacto-ovo, those consume dairy and eggs, 28% roughly. Pesco-vegetarians, you know what that means, right? So they consume fish and dairy, roughly 10% of Seventh-day Adventists. Semi-vegetarians, this is where it gets kind of interesting. Very low, 5.6%. So there's some meat and, meat basically. And the last group, non-vegetarians. You want another percentage? If you haven't already seen it, it's roughly 50%. So exactly 48.3. Half of Seventh-day Adventists are omnivores. And that's the fact, those are the figures. So based on these figures, I'm not going to present the data of these studies, but I just want you to grab, to have an idea of what's going on among us as a group. We're not that homogeneous when it comes to diet. That's the message here. But what is good for the brain? What diet is good for the brain? Before we delve into this, I'd like to bring to you just some foods that are considered brain threats and brain protectors. So here we have the brain threats, just summarized. Don't be concerned about the small font. I'm just going to walk you through. These are dairy and meat products. They have a high content of saturated fats. Then we have the trans fats found in the bakery products. They're famous. They're abundant in airports, right? And in the bakery around the corner, somewhere there. The chemical additives, which are abundant in soft drinks. We also have the caffeine. And alcohol, very popular in any age group, especially millennials. Now, brain protectors. So here we have a list of the main ones, the main foods which are considered brain protectors. The nuts, which have a great source of vitamin E, which is an antioxidant. Then we have the beans and chickpeas, which are rich in fiber and proteins. We have also blueberries and grapes and all kinds of fruits, cherries that have antioxidants. The green leafy vegetables are known to have to be rich in minerals and vitamins. The sweet potatoes, of course, they have the starches, and also potatoes were rich in carbohydrates and other vitamins. And vitamin B12, which is usually advised for vegans so they can supplement. They come in supplemental form. Remember that this week we're talking about the foods and the habits that are empowering the brain, and this is what we have. So this graph is basically a summary of what we have been talking about thus far. Exercise, intellectual stimulation, and sleep complete the chart, and all of these things right here. So you get an idea of where we're getting with this. So let's concentrate on the nutrients, shall we, that which we'll begin to describe between today and tomorrow. Which ones are the nutrients for the brain? Here's an outline.
So the nutrients that we're talking about are carbohydrates as fuel for the brain. Antioxidants provide protection for the brain. Micronutrients, vitamins and minerals, provide the needed items for the metabolism of energy in the brain. Fiber is really important for the brain. Also, avoiding the toxins, the cholesterol, saturated fat, animal products, oils, processed food, and we're going to look at also the last two tomorrow, because we don't have time today to do everything. Healthy carbohydrates. So we think of things as carbohydrates and protein, but actually whole foods have carbohydrate. It has protein, it has fat, it has all the things that you need in a whole food. Potatoes, bread, corn, rice, beans, these are the things that long-lived populations have survived on, and these are the things that are the main source of energy for the brain. If, however, you're getting carbohydrates from donuts and candy bars and candy and Coca-Cola, that's a whole different thing that your body doesn't know how to process. And it shoots your blood sugar up, it wreaks all kinds of havoc, and provides no antioxidants. So we are going to take a few minutes to stretch so that you can get the oxygen going to your brain. And don't forget to rub your neighbor, if you like your neighbor, hopefully. Don't touch anybody that doesn't want to be touched.
You may stand up and stretch. This is a time for that.
And make sure that you get a book. We have these, one for each person.
Yeah, by the way, we have some material. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I bought these to give away to you. I give these to my patients. So these are actually not cheap. They're $2.50. So you're welcome. Each. So if you don't have one, my mom's going to give you one. My parents are here. Thank you, Mom and Dad. Yeah, this is what I give to my patients because I have been, since September, I've been telling them about whole food, plant-based. And then my patients started telling me about the movement online. So there's a big movement among younger people moving toward whole food, plant-based. Just to let you know, if you want to be in on the trend, go whole food, plant-based. It's a trend.
Shall we continue? So let's go down the list. Rhoda brought up the carbohydrates and the right sources of carbohydrates. Let's talk about the antioxidants that protect the brain. Excuse me. So now before we study the antioxidants that protect the brain, let's just briefly cover or discover the things, cover the things that produce oxidative stress. So among those, we have the pollution. Pollution is basically we can avoid it because they're in the environment based on, depending where we live. If we live in an industrial zone, we are exposed to them. In the city, we are exposed to them in great quantities. But they are basically present everywhere to various variable degrees. Inflammation and infection. This means that the oxidative stress from inflammation comes from pathogenic sources. We cannot avoid the pathogens in the environment. As you know, we share the environment with microorganisms. As a matter of fact, they're greater in number than we are, in the trillions and quadrillions. We're talking about bacteria, talking about prokaryotes and so forth. The UV rays, it's a source that comes from industry and technology. They also produce oxidative stress on us if we are exposed in large amounts, to large amounts or constantly. Did you know that eating animal products also can produce oxidative stress? Also eating processed foods and oils. Why is that? Well, because our cells have to metabolize this surplus of animal products, and so they have to work hard. These produce this free radicals. Free radicals. How many of you have heard of free radical formation? They're the product of oxidative metabolism. So free radicals are to be avoided in great amounts in our cells because they have a direct effect on DNA, the DNA molecule. Now, DNA damage can ensue after prolonged exposure to free radicals. Now, free radicals are produced also by normal processes such as mitochondrial respiration, which is basically the biochemical process by which cells harness energy so we can function, so they can function normally. Ionizing radiation can come from, again, technology and certain sources. Occupational hazards is one of them. You know, if you work at a hospital, at a radiology unit, you're prone to experience great amounts of ionizing radiation. We will not talk about this in detail. Inflammation is disease, again, prone and produced by pathogens or the activation of the immune system to combat these pathogens. Smoking is a habitual exposure because one chooses to be basically exposed to the effects, which are the production of free radicals and pollution, as I briefly mentioned. Now, let's talk about antioxidants. What are antioxidants? Antioxidants stabilize free radicals by giving electrons to affected molecules. In other words, in a nutshell, a good antioxidant is a molecule, a compound, that gives off electrons to another compound via chemical reactions that is prone to lose an electron. In other words, if there's a compound that, because of the metabolism and the energy movement there in the cell, prone to lose and generate free radicals, an antioxidant comes in and quenches that propensity of that other compound to lose an electron by donating one electron and quenches it. So this is one chemical property in a nutshell of antioxidants. And our cells have several of those enzymes that allow these two molecules to get together and for these molecules that produce free radicals to be quenched. Burning energy for the brain is an oxidative process. So anything that we do when we think, when we exert ourselves mentally, is producing free radicals, and that must be taken care of. Eat antioxidants and you will learn better is one of the things that we bring, the message that we hope we're bringing today. Where do these antioxidants come from? There it is. It's up there. It's from fruits, vegetables, whole grains, and all plant foods are packed with antioxidants. So this is nothing new, but we wanted to make sure that you are reminded of this fact. Unfortunately, animal foods do not have these antioxidants. And now we were discussing, my wife says, you know what? The fruits and vegetables are like givers, just like antioxidants. Whereas other sources, especially those molecules that come from animal sources, they take and take and take. Think about that analogy. Quite interesting. So here, do not worry about the small font. This is a cell, just like any cell in our organism. This dot, so here's a purple dot where the pointer is. Here is, these are the peroxisomes, organelle of the cell. Another organelle is a lysosome. Another organelle of the cell is a mitochondrium and the endoplasmic reticulum. Those of you in the health sciences know what I'm talking about. And here's the nucleus where the DNA is housed. All of these compartments of the cell contain enzymes that are designed to process free radicals. They have enzymes such as catalase, superoxide dismutase, and so forth that quench, that facilitate the donation of electrons by antioxidant to those compounds that generate the free radicals. You see what I'm talking about? The cell is endowed by this mechanism already. How much more will help the cell, our cells, by putting in this nice compounds from plants, such as beta-carotene, vitamin E, vitamin C, which are antioxidants by their function. And so when we do that, put them into the cells by what we eat, basically, and then metabolism takes place, we are helping our cells to do this process more efficiently. Give them a break. So is that understood? And a wonderful? God made us this way. God made every cell endowed with the mechanisms. So we shall not overwhelm our cells by putting things that would tax this oxidative mechanism already in it. So let me just list some sorts of antioxidants. These are the berries. The picture speaks for itself, I hope. Acai berry. How many of you are familiar with the acai berries? From Brazil, okay? Some of the industry here have tried to put them in drinks, but just a little bit of powder, who knows how many amounts of acai are really there. It's best to go to the source and get in that way. Bilberries, passion fruits, blueberries, kiwi, just go on in the list. Those are good source of antioxidants. You can find this by Googling, but just go online and type sources of antioxidants and you'll see a list of them. Briefly, next in our list is the best food providing vitamins and minerals. Again, no secret where they come from. The picture says it all. It speaks better and louder than I can tell you. But let us go to a question that is often asked. Can I take this in a supplemental form, vitamin E, perhaps. So here's a comparison. This is the vitamin E from natural sources versus an isolated capsule. I can tell you, I had personally done these studies at the University of Illinois. And so I won't tell you the details. What I want to tell you is that every supplement comes in all these forms. So commercially, the supplements are available in these forms right here. Let me just tell you first. Another name for vitamin E is tocopherol. Some of you knew it already, tocopherol. So that is the chemical name. But tocopherol has 8 isomers. In other words, tocopherol comes in 8 forms. Only one of them is the most potent, has the biological action, and it is better absorbed than the other 7. That one is alpha tocopherol, the alpha one. The other ones are delta and epsilon and so forth. So they're according to their chemical conformation. Now, let's look at the subdivision right here briefly before we move on. You'll see the first 3 are all RAC. You want to guess what all RAC means? Let me just explain it to you. It's an all racemic. That means these 3 are cocktails of the 8 forms of vitamin E. And these last 3 only contain the alpha tocopherol. This contain alpha tocopherol plus the other 7. So when you read a supplement, a pill, you have to make sure that you understand what it means. This means if it says RRR, don't worry about what that means. It's just a chemical name designation. It is purer than the ORAC. Now, preliminary research in our laboratories and some collaborators have shown that the RRR form is more effective in eliciting effects, beneficial effects in the brain, at least in the very young mouse. So we don't know. Currently, we're trying, there are clinical studies undergoing to kind of differentiate the effects between the combination of all these 8 racemic forms of vitamin E versus the biologically one, the most active form. And so next, I'm going to leave. Rhoda would explain how much fruits and vegetables should we eat, by the way.
All right. So, well, we need at least, it's a little bit hard to give everyone a rule of thumb because everyone has a different metabolism as far as what to eat. But I really strive to eat at least 3 fruits a day, 3 leafy greens a day, that's the hardest one, 3 other vegetables, and then, so we know 9 a day is good, 12 a day is even better, 15 a day is even better, and there has not been an upper limit on the amount of fruits and vegetables that you can eat to continue to get health benefits. So the more you eat, the better. The higher the dose, the better. And no supplements have matched the nutrient power of fruits and vegetables. Have we emphasized that enough yet? Fiber is also really important for your brain, and only whole foods contain fiber. Most in the U.S., when I worked at Women and Children's in Charleston, the gastroenterologist used to send us 3-day and 5-day diet recalls of people, mostly children. This was a pediatric gastroenterologist, so he would send us those diet histories. The parents would write down everything they ate. And I was always shocked that these children were not eating 1 fruit or vegetable in a whole day. So that means, or in a whole 3 days, actually. So that means the fiber was 0. And most in the U.S. get less than 15 grams. You need a minimum of 30 grams. A whole food vegan diet gets around 60 grams typically. Fiber is really important. It's really important to feed the good bacteria in your intestine, this whole microbiome. Did you know you have more bacteria in your intestines than you have cells in your body? And the microbiome in your intestines as a big determinant of your health and your mental health. So the food that you're eating is not only feeding you, it's feeding the bacteria that's in your intestine. So that's kind of one thing that I keep in mind. It's like, do I really want to feed the bacteria this? Do I really want to help that bad bacteria grow? No. So you don't want to give the food for the bad bacteria. You want to feed the good bacteria. And the good bacteria like to eat the fiber. And this helps your brain. So also fiber, you will have less pain, less distress, better bowel movements, and fiber takes toxins out of your body. Fiber is really very important.
Next up is eliminate toxins. So as Rhoda said, now it's time to eliminate it. So if we eat vegetables and fruits, how can we eliminate toxins and cholesterol? So let's just name them and go down the list. Let's just eliminate them. What? Meat, poultry, and seafood. What else? Eggs, milk, and cheese. Just go down the list. And why is that? Well, let me tell you. Let's just assume that all of us have to eat meat for whatever reason. And who would be at the top of the food chain? Us, humans. And so if we are meat eaters, so then we have to go and get the first animal we find, well, and hunt it and eat it. That animal has concentrated in its tissues, greater amounts of toxins and also pesticides because he roams around and eats it. Every time an animal does that, it concentrates it in its tissues, and we as humans would get it in a concentrated form. Imagine eating every day the same type of meal. Boy, you will accumulate those toxins rather rapidly, wouldn't you say that? So that is what happens with meat eaters. Every step of the food chain concentrates the environmental toxins, so this is what I'm trying to tell you. Now, saturated fats and cholesterol are present in animal products and in the body of all animals, and whenever you feel tempted or you think about meat, think about what I just told you. That is, these are findings actually done by environmentalists and people that work in actually environmental biology in collaboration with nutritionists. The scientists that study the nutritional habits of people. Here is a list of those that are high, that have the highest content of fat. You want to know which ones those are? Seafood, cheeseburger, chicken legs pack a great amount of fats, comparable to beef brains and chicken liver, even although we don't rarely eat these things. Egg yolk packs a great amount of fats as well as cholesterol and milk. So these are proven sources of the greatest amounts of cholesterol and saturated fat, which we must avoid. You may wonder why. Well, let us review this because I know some of you know this information well, but it's worth reminding you of why we must avoid cholesterol and saturated fats. Well, here we have an artery. The artery basically brings oxygen to our tissues, and the liver provides, via metabolism, provides the enough amount of cholesterol that we need. Remember that we need some cholesterol because cholesterol integrates itself into the cell membrane of our cells. And when we have it in normal amounts, physiologically speaking, our cells function better. They're more fluid. But if we add extra cholesterol and fats into the diet from these food sources illustrated right here, we're adding extra cholesterol, and where would they go? Where would they deposit? Remember I told you in the exercise segment about the I don't think I mentioned chylomicrons. We had to take it because we didn't have enough time, but basically there are molecules that transport fatty acids and also cholesterol known as chylomicrons. This, if the diet persists over time, they will deposit in the lining of the arteries and thickening the endothelial layer. And so here we have a picture. This is a normal blood vessel. Then we have an accumulation known as a plaque of fatty acids, chylomicrons, cell debris, because this is trying to, the endothelial cells are trying to get rid of, eliciting a localized inflammation. So all of that causes the blood vessel lining to be damaged, and then there's an accumulation of this debris and plaques, fats, cholesterol, hardens, and it occludes the arterioles and smaller vessels. Those are the ones that suffer the most. Where do we find the smaller vessels? In the capillaries, would you agree? Where do we have great amount of capillaries? We have them in every organ, especially the brain. The brain has the smallest amount, it has the smaller size of arterioles and capillaries. And so this is what a brain looks like, basically, if we were to isolate only the blood vessels. Imagine that the tiniest of blood vessels are occluded by cholesterol. And that's exactly what happens. A lot of neurological patients develop this over time, without symptoms. They don't know what's happening. They're losing areas of their brain slowly until what day? What happens? They fall. They get a stroke, basically. And that happens over time. It is not, unless there's an occlusion due to an accident, but strokes tend to be the result of lifestyle pretty much by the choices of the diet. So don't be exposed to this. The entire vascular system can build up a plaque in no time if we abuse these types of foods from animal products.
How old do you have to be to have plaque?
By the way, I think as old as 10 years old.
There's some studies showing that children age 10, 75% of children age 10 in the United States already have fatty streaks. So it's not a matter of preventing heart disease in children. It's a matter of reversing heart disease in children.
And by the way, the research has shown convincingly that via dietary intervention, that condition can be reversed. Can you believe that? We're going to show you a video at the end of the presentation. Hopefully, I think we're going to have time. Hopefully, we just have to hurry now. And that website, you can find several resources in relation to that. Let's talk briefly about the cheese trap. I have the book here, The Cheese Trap Ourselves. So we have brought it. You may come after our presentation and ask more about this. We have other literature here that we have brought today. Please don't forget to sign also if you're interested in getting the materials that we're presenting to you today. This book is written by Neil Barnard. But I want to show you. He discusses in this book in detail, basically, the myths and realities of the cheese. I am guilty of that because I used to love cheese a lot. By the way, when I was living in Europe and Italy, they used to consume cheese in almost every meal, by the way. And the Americans have adopted that type of, the cheese used to be back in the day just a food that Europeans ate, but all of a sudden we have adopted it in heavily, right? So here's projection data. This is the milk supplied and the dairy world in 2025. These are projections. This is quite interesting. So I'll walk you through here. Let's just concentrate on this red line here on your left and this panel. This is a dairy consumption projection. It is expected to continue to increase steadily by the year 2025. This is because the population increases as well and the demand for dairy product increases. Well, it's expected to increase. Also, the number, now let's move on to the next panel. And here we have two lines. The light blue line right here is the number of milk animals that produce milk. It's expected also to increase, logically, right? Because the demand increases. But
they can't read the numbers of the years.
The average year is expected to increase or give more milk. The animals, I'm sorry, is expected to increase. So these are projections through the years to the year 2025. Basically, that's what we're looking at. So don't be concerned about the numbers. It's too small. But I want you to see the trends and the data lines right here. So this means that the number of milk animals that produce milk is expected to increase while The average production by each animal is expected to increase. How can you do that? Well, this is possible when you manipulate the animal to produce more milk than it ought to or it can. So how do you do that? Well, this is where cows are basically induced to produce milk by hormonal manipulation in constant pregnancies. And normally they live about 20 years, but under these conditions, their lifespan is about 5 or less years. While they're being in absolute distress. Is that normal? Now, another fact, the farm number and size, this is the last panel right here. In yellow or gold, this line in gold reflects the average farm size is expected to increase. But wait a minute, with a caveat. Because the number of farms is decreasing, what does that tell you? This represents the monopoly of the dairy industry by a few industries so that they can have more control of the dairy production in the world. So these are some staggering numbers here that we're looking at. The annual cheese consumption per capita is expected to increase, as we see, linearly from the 70s, and it still continued to increase as the population increases again, thanks to a concerted effort by the media to advertise that you must have cheese in every meal in any form possible because what? It produces happiness. And you would talk a little bit about that. Why? What is the mechanism? A handful of happiness. This is just some cheese. And so this is basically a product of that collusion of money and politics to hide the truth of the dangers of cheese and dairy. Let's not be trapped.
So the cheese, if I don't know if you actually saw this, but even if you go out further, in 1915, Americans ate about 3 pounds of cheese per year. And if you can see this now, we're above 35 pounds of cheese per year per American. So that's the per capita cheese consumption. So I'm just going to shift gears and talk about autism. Autism is a disorder of childhood. It tends to be diagnosed around age 3. We do have a family member, a nephew, who has autism. So we have personal experience with autism and the devastation that it causes. And you can see on this chart, if you look at North America, the incidence of autism has been increasing. When I was in child and adolescent psychiatry fellowship, it was kind of bandied around like, oh, well, maybe the incidence is not increasing. It's just the recognition of the disorder is becoming more prevalent. We're recognizing it more. But I think it's becoming clear that the incidence is increasing. The latest data that we heard from the scientific report is 1 in 45 children is now being diagnosed with autism in the U.S. So, and it's actually increased throughout the world as well. So we can see in this chart also the increase in autism just in the U.S. alone. In the 1970s, it was around 1 or 2 per 2,000. And now the incidence is quite high. One of the possible causes of autism is opioid peptides derived from food. Proteins known as exorphins have been found in the urine of autistic children, and they've been found at higher levels in autistic children than other children. Exorphins and serotonin may be responsible for overstimulating the brain. Dietary exorphin precursors overload may result from increased gut permeability. And there's certain characteristics of children with autism that I've observed that I can share with you. In my clinic, we have a lot of children with autism. They tend to have a lot of asthma. They have a history of a lot of ear infections and surgeries, putting ear tubes in their ears. Constipation is a very common problem in these children, in my experience. Respiratory infections, Also, along with autism, there's a higher prevalence of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Low iron levels is something that I've been seeing as well, and I happen to have researched this when I was at Johns Hopkins, not so much in autism, but in attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. These children tend to have low weight initially when they're younger, and they're very picky eaters, and they often eat dairy heavily. The parents often tell me that that's the only food they will eat. And later, they tend to develop obesity. This is a pattern that I'm seeing quite frequently. And, well, let's make a connection. Milk and cheese block the absorption of iron. And these kids often have low iron, iron deficiency. Dairy contributes to asthma. It increases mucus production. My husband, when he went off of dairy products, he had a decrease in his allergies and symptoms. Dairy is a foreign protein. It activates your immune system. Milk protein has been implicated in diabetes in children, again, activating the immune system to attack the pancreas cells. Dairy causes inflammation, and dairy is addictive. The milk protein, the casein that's found in milk, is changed. Milk and cheese, it's especially concentrated in cheese, and this is what Dr. Neil Bernard talks about in this book. The casein is especially concentrated in cheese, and then your bacteria in your intestine change that to casomorphine. And casomorphine is morphine. It's a drug. It's addictive. And this is why many people find it difficult to give up cheese. And children as well. So casein is changed to casomorphine. A study in 2014 showed the elevated levels of casomorphine in the urine of children with autism. Casomorphine causes constipation because it's like morphine. It's slowing down your intestinal motility. And I can attest to cutting out dairy and animal products as eliminating constipation for me. Milk and egg consumption lead to increased mucus production and ear infections. That's one of the causes of ear infections in children. So I make that connection as well. So if there is a 1% chance that milk and dairy products cause autism, shouldn't we eliminate it from the food supply?
Attacks of apnea, where babies temporarily stop breathing, and muscular atony, where babies go limp after exposure to cow's milk, may also be explained by extracentral activity of casomorphin, meaning outside the brain. Casomorphin, this opiate-like peptide produced by cow's milk, is also responsible for triggering pseudoallergic reactions and other abnormalities seen in crib death. And moreover, similar to morphine, they delay the gastric emptying time, and so may increase the risk of infants refluxing stomach contents back up into their lungs. Thus, it can be said that the so-called milk apnea effect may consist of several components: an opioid-induced respiratory depression, an opioid-induced pseudoallergic histamine-related respiratory response, an influence on the peripheral nervous system, a cow's milk-induced reflux, followed by aspiration-induced apnea. Sudden infant death syndrome is not the only condition linked to these morphine-like compounds. From another medical journal recently, casomorphins liberated from the cow's milk protein, beta-casein, are accused of participating in the cause of such conditions as autism, crib death, type 1 diabetes, postpartum psychosis, circulatory disorders, and food allergies. In terms of autism risk, whereas the human casomorphins, which are the only ones found in the breast milk of women who don't drink cow's milk, are associated with normal psychomotor development and muscle tone. In contrast, elevated levels of bovine casomorphin, found in cow's milk-based formula-fed infants, for example, was associated with a delay in psychomotor development and muscle spasticity. This evidence suggests that the inability of some infants to adequately eliminate bovine casomorphin may be a risk factor for delay in psychomotor development and other diseases such as autism.
We leave you with this message: let food be thy medicine, and medicine be thy food. And this was by Hippocrates. Let's have a prayer. Dear Heavenly Father, we ask you that you give us wisdom when we select the foods we put in our bodies, that we may resist and develop the gusto for the good foods, the hunger for nutrients that would heal us and maintain our health and our lifespan, the life that you've given us. Lord, we ask that you give us wisdom also to share this with others. We know that you've given us a great field of witnessing. We ask you that you give us the drive to share this knowledge that has made so much good and elicit some changes, important changes in our lives. We ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen. This is the time for questions. So if you have any questions, I think there's a microphone that we can pass. Okay, we have two questions right there, the two individuals, right there, the gentleman right there and the lady back there.
Early in your presentation, it showed some of the foods that were good for you, and one of them was corn, but there's very little corn anymore. It's non-GMO. And I was wondering if there's any studies that have to do with that that you would like to present. And then also, as you talk in the autism part there, is there any studies that you have that link dairy and immunizations to the autism? Because you hear a lot of medical profession saying, no, autism has nothing to do with immunizations.
Yeah, so with the corn GMO issue, I'm not an expert on GMOs. I actually try to do organic as much as possible, avoiding the GMOs, but when it comes to, you know, weighing what's the most practical, you know, if it's not practical for you to eliminate corn, I mean, there's a lot of other foods to eat besides corn. So, like, for example, quinoa is a wonderful grain that is pretty much all organic, right?
Right. Regarding GMOs, the data is ambivalent. Some have shown proof that it's actually have effects, and other studies none. Also, you were asking about autism and immunizations, the same. Some studies have shown effects, some others have not shown effects. That's why we are hesitant to conclude based on the evidence, you see. But
it's very difficult to study with the immunization issue.
Right.
As far as, the large studies haven't shown a link with immunization. But even your PI had questions about it.
When I was a student, actually, my mentor had some questions regarding this issue, but she could not arrive to a conclusion. And studying the immune system in itself is very complex, very complicated.
This was her expertise. This was her expertise. Immune,
right.
Brain connections.
And so what we have to do is basically take the body of literature and the current clinical knowledge, and conclude in a way that, you know, you can look for genes. Right now, the field of gene propensity for autism is actually exploding because of the technology. So that's one way that we can go on. Now, having said that, for everyone, think about this. The food we put in produces epigenetic changes that would facilitate the good genes to be turned on and the bad ones to be suppressed. And so even if we don't know the exact mechanisms of the links, we know that by putting good things that would turn on the good genes in our organism, perhaps can give us a greater chance to avoid incidents and mental illnesses such as the autism. So that is where I would tend to go before trying to stipulate exactly what's happening. I don't know if that explain more or less your question.
Yes, I think I
would. I'm following the prompt of my wife. I'm 50-50, but we would for certain infections, yes. I tell you why. Vaccination is very, it's a sophisticated way of helping the immune system, as most of us, I hope you understand this. And so the techniques have been perfected, and it's okay, because basically you're exposing the child, and remember that movie where the king put up and Simba and goes, here it is. So you're presenting your child to the pathogens of the world and saying, I'm going to empower you to defend yourself with a vaccine.
Yeah,
I wouldn't do it totally the widespread.
The other thing that I just triggered my memory is, you know, parents often say this, well, after the immunizations, they developed autism. But think about this. At the same time they get the immunizations, they're taking them off of breast milk and putting them on cow's milk. That's
right.
The same time. So I start thinking, okay, is it really immunizations or is it what you're eating?
It's more than one cause, in other words. There's another young lady here. We'll wait for you. Go ahead.
Coconut oil. Yeah, okay. That's another one that's good to watch. I think nutritionfacts.org has a good video on that.
Yeah.
So coconut oil, any oil is a processed food. So you're taking it out of the coconut and you've refined it down to just the oil. So you have, basically it's breaking down. As soon as you have the oil only, as soon as you have one part of the food only, it's starting to break down. So you really don't want to put that in your body. You want the whole food in your body. You want the whole coconut,
right,
for example. So there's nothing that beats whole foods. I personally, I have occasionally had some coconut oil, I will say that, but over the last, since I started the whole foods. But every time I've done it, I've been sorry. And so I just think the more that we get away from that oil, the better. Dr. Esselstein, who has reversed heart disease with diet alone, he says that oil is the killer of vegans. So it just depends on, you know, what you're willing to put into your body. It's not good to put the oil in your body.
Another thing that I would add just briefly to that question would be that when we eat whole foods, the research has demonstrated, and I know this because when I was preparing a manuscript, I actually had to do my own investigation on this, and it's been proven that when we eat whole foods, there's a synergy in the absorption rates that you won't get just by isolating a particular nutrient or supplement or a specific compound from the whole food. And so that alone should give us evidence that, hey, you know, we were designed to eat whole foods. I mean, this is starting to mount. And so it's quite amazing. We live in amazing times right now that we should take advantage of. Yes.
I just wanted to make a comment about the vaccine issue. I think that there are like more organic ways where you can get vaccines with more pure ingredients. I think there are facilities that do that. And I've read a couple articles on certain vaccines being given too early, and then there's been an instance of increased autism, whereas in other countries they gave that same vaccine later and they didn't have as many cases of autism. Have you heard of this study or do you know anything on that you can comment on?
I have. This is actually came up in a discussion at the Beckman Institute when we were having a seminar, and somebody asked a similar question on the timing of the vaccine. The consensus is that throughout development, the immune system is also developing, and if you help it with a vaccine, it may not be at the right time. Immunologists will tell you that you have to do it in a stepwise fashion. Rhoda also brought up the fact that a lot of moms tend to do various things. So if you see this evidence in one mother, it may not replicate in another because of other interventions that that particular mom is doing, such as wean the baby from milk, maybe the diet change, the dietary change of that particular mother and the environment she's in versus this other mom.
There's so many variables.
There's so many variables. And so it's very difficult to be conclusive with a population doing different things. And we go back again to the Seventh-day Adventist population that is so attractive because we tend to be homogeneous in our habits, but not in our diets. So guess what? When you put these two together, now you can focus on studying the effects of diet because we do everything else similarly, you see? But in the general population, it's very hard to study the effects of the vaccination at in the stages or when you do it and so forth. I don't know if that answers.
Yeah. I wonder if they've thought of looking at that in Adventists, looking at childhood psychiatric mental health diseases in Adventists.
There's so many things that we perhaps can explore. Yeah, oh, I mean, that's the opportunity come up. Yeah, right there. We can come back to you.
There has been many SIDS babies from those shots, too. Mm-hmm. A lot of that's been going on. And I raised a child with the shots, and I said if I ever had a chance to do it again, I would never do it.
Okay. Valid. That's a valid experience.
Sam, when those flies are up there, milk was involved with opiates. I also saw morphine up there. Mm-hmm. What is the causation of the potential of that being set up? Our population is so much involved in heroin, it's so much involved in nursing. Are those stepping stones to addiction in those subject matters?
Yes. Yes, especially in cheese, the casein is concentrated. So it's highly concentrated, and so it's a drug. I mean, you just ask people, what's the hardest to give up?
Is that a stepping stone? Is that causing some of the epidemic we have in this country with the high use of cheese and milk?
I don't know if there's a straight link, but it's activating the same pathways of addiction, similar pathways.
And we're actually going to talk about that tomorrow, too.
Yeah, we're going to expand a little bit tomorrow. I don't know if there's a link, whether it's influencing the epidemics of other drugs, but certainly it's activating the same pathways. So we would not be able to answer whether there's a direct link at this time. But the activation of similar pathways is there, yes, and the brain. The reward pathways we're talking about, by the way. Yes.
Yes, I'd just like to give a testimony. Our son's 15 years old. He comes from a country where they typically, I understand, don't use much inoculation practices. And he went 14 years, was not sick one time, not cold, nothing. Last year, he got sick, was not serious, stayed home, but I've never been around anybody that's gone 14 years and never gotten sick. You know, and
very good.
The rest of us have all been inoculated, and we don't get sick a lot, but we get sick sometimes, you know, and I have to think there's something to that.
You know, getting sick is your body fighting a war with a pathogen. You feel the symptoms. As a matter of fact, getting sick is basically, I can tell you a little bit about that. I'm a neuroimmunologist by training. But overall, if you feel a little ill, not severely, rest. Remember, if you go to see a doctor, it will tell you, you know what? Sleep it off, rest it off, and you'll be fine in a day or two. And that's exactly what we should do. Another thing that we want to talk about, by the way, is to fast, not to eat when you feel some symptoms of flu. Why? You enable your body to concentrate on getting rid of the pathogen, because at that point, cytokines are being released all over the body, and that is the most. If you don't feel symptoms, hey, you're like your son, that means that it has a good, strong immune system. But if you get the symptoms of illness for, let's say, a short period, 24 to 48 hours, rest, shut down some other functions. If it doesn't, recede, then you must see a physician. But if it's only 1 to 2 days, it's normal. I think you can allow yourself to really to really heal itself, and that's usually very good.
My question in regards, I know we keep going back to the immunization thing, but this is a question I've had for a very long time. I know that certain immunizations have certain ingredients that we as Adventists would not consume because they're unclean. So knowing that, that those unclean things are being put into the immunizations, should we put it into our children? Is it clean to do? Like they put, you know, monkeys' blood.
Oh, I see what you
into,
mean.
Into, you know.
Are you suggesting that? Well, are you implying that this, the vaccinations, they come from other species?
Right. They have other species that are considered unclean on the biblical principle.
My, I think Rhoda would concur in this. If you are ambivalent and you're hesitant on an intervention, don't do it. Because it's worse to be conflicted in your mind about it, and be, and you can pass that, those feelings on to the child so that your influence as a parent is very strong. If you are conflicted about that, the precedence of the vaccine, where it comes from, how it was made, then I would suggest perhaps not to go with it. Yeah, you know, that's a personal choice that everybody makes. Again, isolated proteins or vaccines and factors are basically molecules. And across the animal kingdom, we share isoforms of the same proteins and immune factors, basically. They fight disease in a similar way than we do. That's why we scientists use animals as models to study the inflammatory response and also the pathogenic infection response cycle. And so having said that, just it's kind of, I know I understand the approach by the general public that, okay, they don't think in terms of molecules, proteins like we do, right? You tend to think in more in terms of the whole, you know, where it came from and things like that. And if it's conflictive, I would advise you to talk to a professional, help you understand what's going on, the way I'm trying to explain to you in this setting, but have someone you really trust, a health professional, and tell him your concern, and hopefully he is or she is able to explain it to you in a way that you can make an educated decision, if you will.
Up on your chart there where you showed the incidence of autism on some of the different countries there, if you notice on your one there where you showed in, right there, if you show East Asia there, very little autism, not only did they not do much of any dairy, but they don't immunize any of their children till after they're two. So you have those two things helping them to stay away from the autism.
Absolutely. Lifestyles definitely play a role, yes. Very good observation, by the way, you picked on those. Anybody else? Okay, so I hope that we were able to guide you to some of this new findings. Tomorrow we're going to do part two. So tomorrow is a continuation, and tomorrow we're going to focus on one, Rhoda. Some disease.
So particular brain problems as well as looking at the addiction issue.
Some depression, I believe.
Depression, yeah, we're going to cover depression, that's true.
So if you want to learn about nutrition and depression, tomorrow is the day to come. We have some interesting data. It's just a continuation of this. We again appeal to you to be mindful of what we put in our bodies, and we're very passionate because it's still making a difference in our lives. We don't pretend to know it all, by the way. We're still investigating, learning, and every time we discover something new, we get excited because, as Rhoda shared with you, has made a difference in your life and in mine too. I have also my own story, but this is also a good thing. God bless, and you're dismissed for today. We'll see you tomorrow at the same time, 4 p.m.
And don't forget to give us your information.
If you want this, yes, give us your information.